welcome to episode 136 of the Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. It is Saturday, December 4th, 2010. I am the Solo Monster back here with you, and very, very pleased to be back here this particular weekend, as I was not sure what weekend I might be able to come back and do a new podcast. I've been posting up a couple of vintage episodes, number 50, number 26. For those of you on Facebook, you've been able to listen to those. But thankfully, I am on the road to recovery here from my recent illness, which was no fun at all. And my voice is not perfect, but it is such that I can do a show, whereas earlier in the week, I just could not even speak. There was absolutely no possibility whatsoever in my mind of doing a sound off. But thankfully, due to a combination of steroids and pain pills, I have officially become a professional wrestler. I am doing better, and we have a lot of new stuff to talk about, some fresh stuff to talk about here, but I just want to say quick thanks to everybody who is sending messages and emails and posting on Facebook and whatnot, you know, wishing me well and to get better and all that. That's pretty cool. I really appreciate that. Mono is not a fun thing, but to be perfectly honest with you, the only real ill effects I was feeling was with my throat. So, of course, naturally, when you do a podcast and you happen to come down with something that affects your throat, that's not a good thing. So, yeah, the swelling of the glands in the throat and the pain that, I mean, I have never experienced pain like that in my entire life. Just to take a swallow was like the worst agony you could possibly imagine. I mean, I went online, I'm looking to find out if this is normal. And I'm reading accounts from people from all walks of life, including athletes, who describe themselves as being pretty tough and having a high pain tolerance, and they've broken bones before, and yet they were completely crippled by the worst sore throat you could possibly imagine. And I know now of what they speak. They're not lying. It is not fun at all. But thankfully, that's behind us now, and we can move forward, my enlarged spleen notwithstanding. I did check out the three-hour King of the Ring edition of Raw this past Monday night. I mean, what else did I have to do? Not much. Checked it out. Now, how does it rate against previous King of the Ring tournaments? Obviously, not among the best, but not among the worst either. I think the 2008 tournament was the last one. That was the one that William Regal won, which was a complete abomination. That was the one where he beat Hornswoggle in the opening round at about 20 seconds, and I think he might have actually gotten a bye. And beat CM Punk in some quick four-minute match in the finals. It was a big, big disappointment. And the follow-up was a big disappointment, largely in part due to William Regal himself, who got popped on a second wellness violation, and whatever big push he was getting or they had planned for him pretty much went bye-bye at that point. So King of the Ring 08, pretty forgettable. King of the Ring 06, which was actually used as a gimmick on SmackDown, that was that gave birth to the King Booker character, which, you know, certainly did a lot to, I think, lengthen Booker's career in WWE. It led to a World Heavyweight title run there in 06, but I think King Booker wore its welcome out very, very quickly, and I don't necessarily look back fondly on that particular character. Before 06, the tournament, you have to go all the way back to 2002. That was when it was last run as a standalone pay-per-view event before it was discontinued because of low buy rates. And there were plenty of King of the Ring tournaments that I liked more so than this year. My all-time favorite was 1993. If people listening to this podcast have never seen the 1993 King of the Ring tournament, the King of the Ring pay-per-view, you need to go and find yourself a copy online or buy it somewhere. Find a copy of it and watch it from start to finish. As a whole, the pay-per-view I thought was good. It wasn't great. There was some crap on it. And even some of the matches in the tournament itself. You know, that was a tournament that featured such illustrious first-round battles as Mr. Perfect and Mr. Hughes, Bam Bam Bigelow and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. There was a 15-minute time limit draw between the Narcissist Lex Luger and Tatanka, but I didn't think that was a horrible match. All things considered, but it's all about Bret Hart. It's the Bret Hitman Hart show. You know, Bret comes out, he wrestled Razor Ramon in the opening round. They had a pretty good match, nothing great, but they had a good match. But it was Bret's match with Mr. Perfect in the semifinals, which I would argue in some ways is even better than their SummerSlam classic from 91. certainly a lot stiffer. And then the finals between Brett and Bam Bam Bigelow, which had a bit of a fuck finish toward the end that really wasn't. The match kept going. That was kind of stupid. But the match itself, I thought, was... it's one of the more underrated WWE pay-per-view matches I've ever seen. And the big thing about 93 was the story that they told. You know, Bret Hart did so well, more than any other main eventer I can remember in WWE. Bret Hart can make it seem like he was truly getting his ass kicked. And he was truly in pain. And he was truly suffering and scratching and fighting and trying to claw his way back. I think after the opening round, he came out for a second match with his fingers taped as though they were broken, which, of course, you know, his opponents would hone in on that and would stomp on the fingers and all that. Bret took a beating in that tournament, and on top of that, he had two really, really great matches in the semis and the finals, and won the crown, and then we all know what happened with the coronation. That, of course, was the kickoff of the Bret Hart-Jerry Lawler feud back in 93. Anyway, the point is, that was the best King of the Ring tournament I've ever seen. 2010, all things considered, it was pretty good. You know, they gave a little more time to the matches in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, especially the finals with Sheamus and Morrison. I'd have to go back and check. In reality, it probably only got like 7 or 8 minutes. It felt like a little bit longer. The crowd really got into that match towards the end. They were really hot for it. I don't remember if I actually predicted it on this podcast. I know when I did my King of the Ring editorial for SC Scoops a couple weeks back, I predicted King Sheamus, and that's exactly what we got. Sheamus, of course, wins the King of the Ring tournament, beats John Morrison in the finals, which makes sense because Morrison got a clean win over the former world champion at the Survivor Series. And so Sheamus takes the crown, and obviously, you would have to imagine, sets up the obvious King of Kings versus King of the Ring feud for whenever Triple H is good and ready to make his TV return. So let's go back here. May as well just break down Raw a little bit, at least the significant portions of Raw. I thought that Sheamus and Morrison probably had the best match overall in the tournament because of the heat at the end of that battle. But the first match we saw on Monday was Daniel Bryan against Alberto Del Rio, who probably, aside from Sheamus, was one of the favorites in the tournament. Del Rio won the match. It was a very good match. No surprise there. I have yet to see a Daniel Bryan match since he has won the U.S. title that has been anything short of very good. So they had a pretty good match. What other things happened here? John Cena. Where to begin with John Cena? John Cena is supposed to be fired from WWE. And of course, we all know he's not really fired. But the only question is, would they at least keep him off television for a couple of weeks to sell the stipulation from the Survivor Series? Of course, they couldn't even do that. They were extremely worried that ratings would go down. We have to have Cena on the show in some way. They came up with this Juan Cena masked luchador gimmick, which apparently is only going to be for the house shows. I mean, I guess they could change their mind, but there was certainly no sign of Juan Cena on TV, so that's their house show excuse. And if you've seen photos of him with the mask on, it's really rather uncreative. They literally just put a purple mask on him, and otherwise he pretty much looks and acts the exact same way that he always does. So, you know, at least with Mr. America, they kind of took it a little bit further. You know, they had Hogan wear these long blue pants with the mask and just dress a little more, you know, unlike Hulk Hogan. But regardless, we see John Cena on Raw Monday night. He comes out through the crowd. He's got tickets. He bought tickets to the show. So technically speaking, he's supposed to be just like you and me. Of course, we know that's pretty far from the truth, but he's supposed to be like any other paying fan. Pays for a ticket, sits in the crowd. Of course, John Cena hops the barricade, beats up Nexus, runs away. Nobody stops him. No security, no police. Now, I know John Cena came out later and said, look, the reason security is not so quick to stop me is because you Nexus fools beat them up when you first came in back in June. I find that a little hard to believe that they have the same security staff for every single show, but whatever. But again, it doesn't answer the question of why John Cena would come back later on and be put on the Titantron. I mean, I suppose you could say that Nexus has been running roughshod over WWE to the point where nobody in the company likes them, and so they're willing to, you know, put Cena on camera and do all these things, but this is stretching it way too far. This is really, really stupid. You know, Cena was on the Titantron in the parking lot. Him and the rest of the Raw roster, which looked really fucking pathetic, if that was the entire Raw roster, beat the hell out of Nexus. Really beat the hell out of Justin Gabriel. Cena threw him into a car, and his head proceeded to smash a window on the right side of the car. And then Cena gave him an FU on the car and all that. Point is, Cena is going to continue to appear on Raw every single week and torment the Nexus until Wade Barrett agrees to reinstate him and they will have a match on pay-per-view. And that's all well and good for people who want to see John Cena get his revenge, but again, I think I've talked about this ad nauseum before, it just further cements the fact that stipulations in WWE matches don't mean jack shit. Nobody expected Cena to be off TV for months and months and months to sell the stipulation. Of course, they were stupid for having that stipulation in the first place. But at least keep him off TV for a couple of weeks. Keep him off TV until after TLC and then bring him back for the Rumble. You could do that. Believe me, Raw will not collapse without John Cena for 3 or 4 weeks, but they couldn't even do that. It's like a child with ADD. They just can't help themselves. So I don't like this. Look, I didn't pay money to see Survivor Series. I did see Survivor Series. I didn't pay money to see it. So I can't be too upset over it. But I could see where if somebody paid $45 on Survivor Series, and let's be honest, it was really a one-match show. They did a hell of a job promoting that main event as opposed to the main event from last year's show. And I could see where people would be upset over paying money for Survivor Series for a stipulation that they already reneged on, for a pay-per-view where the very next night, if you recall, we had at least two Survivor Series rematches. Miz cashed in his Money in the Bank and won the title on Raw for free and not on the pay-per-view. So yeah, I could see where people would be pissed off. I had people email me pissed off. And I didn't say this to them when they emailed me, but the fact is, I kind of warned you about that. And I told you that these pay-per-views, more often than not, are not worth the money that they charge for. So if you buy the pay-per-view and are then upset that they gave something away for free on Raw, or you feel deceived in some way, you kind of don't have anybody to blame but yourself. I can't even blame WWE because they've been doing it for so long. If you're dumb enough to pay money for these pay-per-views and then be pissed off about stuff like this, truth be told, you got to look in the mirror. It's your own fault. Then again, some people probably bought Survivor Series and were very happy with their purchase. Good for them. I hope they are. But if you're not, you can't really blame WWE anymore. They've been doing it for so long that I think if they didn't do that, that would be more shocking than anything else. Anyway, we had a couple of more first-round matches. Morrison advanced over Cody Rhodes. Ezekiel Jackson and Drew McIntyre went to a draw. What a shitty match that was. And then we had The Miz come out with Alex Riley, who's great in the role, although I wasn't all that enthusiastic about him poking fun at his own DUI on the show. I think that was pretty fucking stupid. But Miz comes out for his celebration, and of course he puts Miz Girl up on the Titantron. That girl will be scarred for life. And cuts a very impassioned promo about people telling him that he would never amount to anything, he would never be WWE champion. He seems to bring up JBL all the time whenever he does a promo like this because JBL didn't like him and used to rib him backstage. So there's a legitimate disdain there for JBL. For what it's worth, JBL, I think, has commented it before on his Twitter and whatnot that he actually likes The Miz and he's happy for him. Of course, he says that now. But nonetheless, JBL and Miz certainly have two things in common. They're two people that I don't know that many people expected them to become WWE champions, so they at least have those two things in common. Or that one thing, I should say. But anyway, the point of all this was Miz is cutting this promo and talking about the fact that there have been legends in this industry, Hall of Famers. He mentions Ricky Steamboat by name and Roddy Piper, who were legends, Hall of Famers, but they were never WWE champion. And at this point, Jerry Lawler gets up from the announce booth, and by the way, I would be remiss if I didn't mention how fucking awesome CM Punk has been on Raw the last couple of weeks. I love the fact that Punk came out wearing a sport coat over a Colt Cabana t-shirt. And by the way, you can go to Colt Cabana's Twitter and buy that t-shirt if you want to. The I Love Colt t-shirt with the Jewish star. But Punk you know, Punk's not perfect. You know, towards the end of the show, when he was the only one left out there doing commentary, a little rocky, but he brings a certain freshness to the show, to the announce table, that I appreciate. And I'll tell you what, he's only going to get better, but he's not doing this long term, and that's kind of a shame. You know, when his injury heals up, when that hip injury is all better, probably by January or so, I would imagine, certainly in time for the Royal Rumble, Punk is going to be back as a full-time performer, and he'll be out of the announce booth, and that will be a sad day when that happens. So anyway, Jerry Lawler gets up during this promo and says, you know what, Miz, I'm one of those people on your list of legends that have never become WWE champion. And one thing leads to another. Michael Cole stands up. He gets involved in the promo. You can clearly tell Michael Cole staring down at the announce desk, reading from a script. He has a bad habit of doing this. Most of the time when he reads those anonymous GM emails, instead of looking at the goddamn computer screen, he's too busy looking down at a piece of paper. I don't understand how difficult would it be to take whatever is written on that paper and actually put it in a large, tight font on the fucking computer screen so he can just read it off the screen and not make it look so fake. Is that so hard? So, anyway, Michael Cole annoyed me during this segment because of that. But that's a nitpick. So, Miz has no interest in defending his title on this particular night. Cole made a comment that gave Lawler an idea. Lawler says, you know what? How about you defend the title against me? Miz didn't want any part of that. The GM dinged in. One thing led to another. And the match was made. Jerry Lawler challenging The Miz for the WWE Championship in a tables, ladders, and chairs match. Now, the one thing that kind of concerned me about this is that it was only a couple of weeks ago that we weren't even sure if Lawler was going to be on Raw, because he was still recovering from a pretty severe staph infection in his knee. You know, Lawler competes on the independents pretty much every weekend. I guess he must have suffered an injury, and it got infected, and that's pretty serious stuff, and he's first getting over that infection. So I was a little concerned about that. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. I'm sure he's all better now, but that did concern me a little bit. But that led to the main event, which we'll get to in a second. They had a segment later on, excuse me, because at this point Lawler left the announce booth, and it was Michael Cole and CM Punk for the rest of the show. And they had a segment backstage where Arn Anderson came up to Jerry Lawler and they talked, and that was awesome. And then they had a Lawler video package, which I'm pretty sure was some variation of probably his Hall of Fame video package from a couple of years ago. But this was great stuff. And it was perfect because a lot of the fans, especially the younger fans watching now, have no idea that Jerry Lawler was a wrestler, like a full-time wrestler, let alone had a very successful career for himself outside of WWE. You know, a lot of people don't know that Jerry Lawler held literally over 100 championships. They don't know that he beat Curt Hennig to become the AWA champion in the late 80s. They don't know about the Jerry Lawler-Andy Kaufman feud from the early 80s. They showed clips of that during the video package. They really made Lawler out to be a big deal in this video, and they needed to do that. So between the backstage segment with Arn Anderson and between the video package and hyping it up constantly, and Punk did a pretty good job of hyping it up and giving Jerry Lawler props on commentary, they did a better job of hyping this main event on Raw and making it feel special than they do for most of their pay-per-view main events. And there's a lesson there. So you have Miz and Jerry Lawler in the main event. As a TLC match, it was probably one of the more uneventful TLC matches you will ever see in terms of bell-to-bell action. Lawler is 61 years old. This was his birthday. He didn't do much. He didn't really take too many bumps. There were no big flips in this match or any of the acrobatics that you're probably used to seeing in a TLC match. But there is no wasted motion when Jerry Lawler is in that ring. Plus, Jerry Lawler still has one of the best punches. He throws one of the best punches in the business still to this day, even at 61 years of age. Midway through the match, he knocked Alex Riley off the apron through a table. That took Riley out of the equation. At this point, the fans begin buzzing a little bit because they think, all right, you know, I don't know that anybody goes into this match thinking Lawler has a chance. Now it's up to Lawler to do his job. It's up to Lawler to convince the crowd that he, in fact, does have a chance to become WWE champion. So the match goes on. There's, you know, Lawler at one point is taking a chair to The Miz. The Miz is taking a chair to Lawler. There's slams. There's this. There's that. And then there's a table that was set up earlier in the match by Lawler on the outside. And you know that that table at some point is going to come into play, and it does. At one point, Miz is up on the top rope. Lawler knocks him off, and he comes crashing down through the table. Now, at this point, Lawler collapses in a heap in the ring, and the crowd is going fucking insane because they realize this is it. This is his moment right here. The Miz has been incapacitated. He has been put through a table on the outside. Alex Riley is down. This is Jerry Lawler's opportunity to become the WWE champion. And the crowd is totally into this. They're totally buying into the fact that King could very well win the title. And Lawler begins slowly climbing the ladder, and each rung that he climbs, the crowd gets louder and louder. People are standing. It's just incredible stuff. So Michael Cole, in a desperate bid to try to revive The Miz, leaves the announce booth, which leaves CM Punk alone on commentary, which was interesting that they would put him in that position. And Punk is totally playing babyface, ragging on Cole, calling him unprofessional. He's basically rooting for the King. Clearly, he wants the King to win this match. So what happens as Lawler gets closer to the championship, Michael Cole runs into the ring and grabs his foot. And just the sign of a classic heel. People are angry. They're pissed off. They're very upset at what they've just seen. Of course, Lawler plays the role of stupid wrestler, as they always do in this case. It's like when somebody's music plays and they get distracted, which actually happened with, it wasn't music, but Alberto Del Rio earlier in the tournament was distracted when Rey Mysterio was honking his car horn. But nonetheless, King climbs down instead of grabbing the title belt. He comes down from the ladder. He confronts Michael Cole, asks him, "What the hell are you doing?" Cole is apologizing, and Lawler promptly pops him right in the mouth. He mounts him. He's grounding and pounding him on the ground, beating the crap out of him. The Miz starts climbing the ladder. Lawler sees him, and now we have Lawler on one side of the ladder, The Miz on the other. They're fighting atop the ladder, punching one another in the head. Miz grabs the belt, smashes the belt into Lawler's head. Lawler, of course, braces himself for the big tumble, falls from the ladder. Miz takes the championship belt down and wins the match. This was phenomenal stuff. This will go down as one of the best matches on Raw in 2010. It was very reminiscent, of course, of the Edge-Ric Flair TLC match for the title back in 2006, although that match, I guess you could say that match was better in some ways. It was certainly more brutal. You know, that was back when there was no blood ban, there was no, you know, they weren't PG. So there was a lot more violence, a lot of blood. Of course, it's Ric Flair. How can you have a Ric Flair match with no blood? Ric Flair would never survive wrestling in WWE in 2010 because as soon as he gets hit, the match would have to stop. But it was very reminiscent of that match in that here is the young heel champion that they're trying to get over. And so they decide to put him in the ring with the old, crusty, wily Hall of Famer who they know can obviously knows how to work, and they know that they can hook the crowd in a way that most other people can't. They can get people into the match, they can get people to believe that there may be a title change, even though you know any smart person with a brain knows, especially the week after winning the title, they're not going to take the belt off The Miz. But for a split second there, you probably thought that they actually might give Lawler a quick run as champion on his birthday. You just thought for a quick split second. This was just a really, really fun match. And I don't have a problem with them giving it away for free on TV, you know, a TLC match 2 weeks or whatever before the actual TLC pay-per-view, because let's be honest here, it's not going to make a damn bit of difference. It's not going to cost them any buys. These pay-per-view buys are dwindling every single month anyway. If anything, perhaps if people watch this match, this was a fucking great match, maybe there'll be some more people who buy the pay-per-view. So I don't have a problem with them putting this match on TV like this, with this particular stipulation. This was actually a great way to highlight how fun TLC matches can be. So Lawler did an incredible job. But the problem we now have is this. Lawler and Cole, for as much as Cole has been acting heelish over the last couple of months, Lawler and Cole still get along. They don't really fight. You know, Lawler obviously on TV was getting a little hot under the collar at Cole a couple of weeks back during the old school Raw when Cole kept talking over JR. But aside from that, they get along just fine. You know, they come off as being friends. But now you have this unique situation where Michael Cole pretty much went full on heel on Monday night. He basically cost Jerry Lawler the WWE Championship. The one thing that has eluded him his entire career, 40 years in the business, and Michael Cole, of all people, the Andy Kaufman of this generation, only not, cost him the title. How do you have Raw next Monday night with Lawler and Cole sitting next to each other coexisting as though nothing ever happened? You can't. It's just impossible. It's completely illogical. And they need to address this. They need to have a plan. They need to know where they're going with this, because you better have a damn good explanation if you're going to just have Cole and Lawler sitting there next week as though nothing ever happened. Which brings us to NXT. Now, again, in my medicated, bored state with nothing else to do, I decided to watch NXT, in part because it was the season finale, Season 3. So I said, let me watch this crap and see what they have planned. So as soon as they go on the air, you have Michael Cole and Josh Matthews on commentary, and they actually had Michael Cole address this situation. They showed highlights of what happened on Monday night, and Michael, a very somber and quiet Michael Cole, basically said he doesn't know why he did what he did on Monday night. He doesn't have a real good explanation for it. He was going to plan on reaching out privately during the week to Jerry Lawler to talk to him, and he would have no further comment until Raw next Monday night, when he would address this situation further. Perfect. They handled that perfectly. You had to have Cole address it in some way, which they did, but you didn't want to have him give everything away on fucking NXT on the internet where 12 people watch it. So we now have a hook for Raw next week, where Michael Cole apparently is going to publicly address what he did last week and why he did what he did. And I guess Jerry Lawler will be there to react to it, and we'll see where they go with this. But that was actually a very good way for them to address it on NXT. Now, before we get to NXT, for those of you thinking that, well, Solomonster, the reason that this is happening is because there's going to be a big announcer shakeup. They're going to bring back Jim Ross. Here's the situation as it stands with the announcing. Todd Grisham, who up until a few months ago when Michael Cole came to SmackDown was the play-by-play man for Friday Night SmackDown, and he's still part of the announce crew, Todd Grisham is not very high on the list of Vince McMahon these days. Vince is just not happy with him. And they do have some plans to potentially shake up the announce teams. Jim Ross is not in those plans. Vince McMahon does not want Jim Ross back full-time. Kevin Dunn, head of production, executive producer, whatever you want to call him, does not want Jim Ross back full-time. Ultimately, the decision is Vince McMahon's. What Vince and Kevin Dunn share in common is a desire for a more youthful look for their announcers. That's what they want. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's what they want. Jim Ross, of course, would love to come back. You know, he talks on his Twitter and his blogs about how he doesn't want to travel, you know, 51 weeks a year, and I'm sure he doesn't. But if he were offered the Raw announce gig back, he would take it in a heartbeat. Do not let that fool you. He would take it in a fucking heartbeat. So he wants to come back. Believe me, he loved it being back a couple of weeks ago for that one match. But that was shocking enough that they would even bring him back for that. But I think part of it, and I've read this and I agree with this, is the mentality there was it was an old school show. And so therefore, by bringing Jim Ross back for one night as part of the quote-unquote old school crew, they're trying to position him to the casual fan as being part of the old school, in that you don't want to see this guy every week. He belongs with, you know, the legends like Gene Okerlund and people like that who make comedy appearances every now and then. Of course, you and I both know that Jim Ross can still do this gig better than anybody else they have under contract. So that's kind of where things stand. They don't want to bring Jim Ross back full-time. Jim Ross would love to come back full-time. And in fact, what I found interesting to read about is that Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole, behind the scenes, have actually pitched to management the idea of having Jim Ross come back to work with them as part of a three-man announce booth for the pay-per-views. I don't know that Vince McMahon would ever do something like that. I don't know that Vince would want to put somebody on the announce crew who's not on their weekly television show. This stems for two reasons. Number one, Cole and Lawler have a tremendous amount of respect for JR, and they would love to work with him. But the other thing is, they both don't like Matt Stryker. In fact, Lawler hates Matt Stryker. And apparently there was an incident at the Survivor Series pay-per-view where, at one point, off-camera, I guess after a match, Michael Cole actually took his headset off and laced into Matt Stryker for talking too much. So they both do not have a... Well, let's put it this way. Cole and Lawler have a mutual disdain for Matt Stryker. And they would love to have Jim Ross permanently replace him as part of a three-man pay-per-view booth. So they've gone to management with that idea. I don't know that they've made a decision one way or the other. I just can't see Vince McMahon agreeing to something like that unless Jim Ross were to come back full-time, which, again, Vince doesn't want. Now, just because Vince doesn't want that doesn't mean that he cannot be convinced. Remember, Vince has tried to replace Jim Ross no less than three or four times over the last several years, and Jim Ross would always eventually come back. This is the longest stretch that they've gone without Jim Ross as a regular on-air commentator. So I think in his mind, Vince thinks, you know, it's been a couple of years, I finally did it, I got rid of him, why would I bring him back now? For Vince, that would be an admission of being wrong, of having made a mistake, which would be very much unlike Vince McMahon to do something like that. So there may well be an announcing shakeup, but we're not just talking Raw. It may be more of a shakeup on the SmackDown brand than anything else. You know, if I were booking, I would love to book a Michael Cole-Jerry Lawler match on pay-per-view with the stipulation that, you know, if King were to win, Jim Ross comes back. I mean, I think that would be fantastic. But that's not the direction they're going in. So for those people who think, oh, it's a foregone conclusion that JR is coming back, obviously that's where they're going with this, I wouldn't be so quick to assume that. I would not be so quick to assume that. So we'll find out where they're going to go on Monday night, because they need to have one hell of an explanation if Cole and Lawler are going to continue working together on camera. Anyway, NXT Season 3 is over. It came down to Caitlyn, who, of course, was Vicky Guerrero's rookie, and Naomi, who I believe was Kelly Kelly's rookie. Kelly Kelly was not there. She is on an overseas tour with Eve, Big Show, and Vince McMahon in Afghanistan. So it came down to fan voting, pro voting, and the two things gave Caitlyn the victory, which should really be a surprise to nobody. It doesn't really matter because Caitlyn, Naomi, and AJ, I believe, are both going to be on TV full-time. I would imagine that AJ will probably be a love interest slash valet for Primo Cologne, who was her pro. They did swap some spit on NXT this week, so way to go, Primo. But the three of them are going to be on TV regardless. I don't know what they're going to do with the other divas. You know, I know Jamie was cut a while back. I was surprised that they brought her back and put her on TV this week. But they brought all the rookie divas back to make an appearance and kind of, you know, give their thoughts on who they thought would win. Jamie was one of those people. Oksana, you know, Oksana is an interesting one because with that accent and the way she says, you know, double-double-E, they did the storyline with her in Goldust. It's hard for me to believe they're just going to cut her or not keep her as a character going forward. I could see them keeping her on as maybe like a comedy character, but they probably will just end up sending her back down to FCW. Just because you don't win NXT doesn't mean you get fired. You probably just get sent down to developmental unless they see absolutely no hope for you, in which case they will get rid of you. So Caitlyn wins NXT. I would imagine she'll continue to be on the SmackDown brand, part of that whole love triangle deal with Dolph Ziggler and Vicky Guerrero. And hey, as long as Caitlyn continues to be on TV, that's reason enough to watch whatever show she's on. So that leads to the question of what happens now to NXT. It has been confirmed that Tough Enough is going to come back. In fact, they're doing casting calls right now for the new season of WWE Tough Enough, which will be airing, I would imagine, sometime in 2011 on the USA Network. In fact, one of our good friends, a good friend of the Sound Off, the ECW zombie himself, Tim Arson, has thrown his name in the hat to be a contestant on the latest season of Tough Enough. You can actually vote for him online right now. Show some love for the zombie. So with Tough Enough coming back at some point next year, it begs the question, do you even need NXT anymore? Apparently WWE thinks so because there will be a Season 4 of NXT, which of course here in the States will be airing exclusively on WWE.com. It will not be on television. So we have the roster here. May as well run through it real quick. Of NXT Season 4. Pros and rookies. First of all, we have Daniel Bryan making his NXT return, this time as a pro. He'll be mentoring Derek Bateman. Derek Bateman was mostly a tag team guy in Florida Championship Wrestling. In fact, I think he was tag team champions down there with one of the other new NXT rookies by the name of Johnny Curtis, who will be mentored by R-Truth. We have Alberto Del Rio, who will be mentoring somebody by the name of Connor O'Brien. Gee, I wonder where they got that name from. He used to be known as Ryan O'Reilly. He's a big guy. He's probably about 280, 290. And there were some talks of him getting called up to the ECW roster a couple of years ago. He's been with the company for a while now. I don't think he ever did get called up, but he'll be on TV now. And we have Dolph Ziggler, the Intercontinental Champion. He will be the mentor for Jacob Novak. They had little promo packages for these guys on NXT on Tuesday. I think Jacob Novak was the one. They're already sticking these guys with stupid gimmicks. I think Novak was the one. He has this gimmick where, almost like a JBL businessman type gimmick. It was just so corny and so stupid. Just, do they really need gimmicks at this point? I mean, I know at some point they're going to be saddled with a ridiculous gimmick, but do they need them now? Anyway. Novak is new. I don't know anything about him. I haven't been able to find out much about him. But obviously they see something in him because they're putting him on TV. So you have him. Chris Masters is going to be a pro, which is comical. He'll be mentoring Byron Saxton. Now you may recall Byron Saxton was actually brought up to TV for a brief period of time. Back in, I guess it would have been 2006, 2007. As an announcer on the ECW broadcast team. He actually is probably going to be the standout guy in this competition. Based on everything I've read, and I'm not an FCW expert, so I've had to do some reading on this, but I've not heard a bad word said about Byron Saxton. In fact, in the promo package they showed on Tuesday night, he probably looked the best as well. He talks really, really well, which should be no surprise since they put him on an announce team at one point. I think he's also done commentary in FCW alongside Dusty Rhodes. So he's got the gift of gab. Apparently, you know, he's got the look physically. He's a good worker. So he's got a main event personality. So I would say Byron Saxton may be the dark horse of this competition. And lastly, we have Ted DiBiase, who will be the pro for Brodus Clay, who at one point in FCW was known as, I believe, G-Rilla. Used to be his old name. This guy, my God. They had a promo package for him on Tuesday night. And, you know, physically, he's a big guy. You know, I'll say that much. He's not jacked. He's just, I won't call him fat, even though he kind of is. He's just a big guy. I can't vouch for how he is as a worker, but apparently he's billing himself as a suplex machine. Boy, we haven't heard that one before. He's basically like, I guess he's positioning himself as Taz, only about a foot taller and about 150 pounds heavier. And it was funny, too, because when they showed that package on NXT and they came back to the announcers, they showed Michael Cole, and Cole made a comment to the effect of, boy, I know somebody's not going to be too happy about that. He started laughing. So no comment yet from Taz on what he thinks about all this, but that should be an interesting response from him when he finds out that this guy is billing himself as the human suplex machine. So those are your rookies. I guess the new season kicks off next week on WWE.com. So if you, for those of you who didn't follow NXT much, perhaps because it was a diva season and you didn't really care much for the women, Now we got the guys again, and I don't know what to think. You know, the thing about NXT Season 3, I didn't watch all of it. It was awful. But it really was awful in such a way that you almost had to watch. It was entertaining in that respect. And I think now that they're going back to the guys, and they're obviously going to take it more serious, I don't think you'll have Michael Cole, you know, coming out there every week snoring on the air and talking about how boring the show is. This show is either going to be really, really boring or really, really entertaining because the guys on the show are that good. And I'm not sure that they have enough guys on this show that are truly that good. So we'll see. We'll see how the next season compares to Season 3. It kicks off next week. Last thing here, big piece of news that broke on Thursday. Montel Vontavious Porter, MVP, was officially granted his release from World Wrestling Entertainment and wish well in his future endeavors. MVP went on his Twitter shortly after the announcement was made on WWE.com and made it known that he asked for his release. He was not fired. He does not hold the company responsible for getting rid of him. In fact, he appreciates the fact that the company obliged to his request and granted him his release. And why not? I mean, they haven't done shit with him for so long. We all know the story. You know, it goes back to an incident that took place backstage probably 2 years ago at this point. But people in that company have long memories, unfortunately. And he made a stupid comment to a drug tester. It was stupid. But to constantly punish him for that, unless his overall attitude backstage was just that bad, I mean, none of us really know for sure. You know, maybe he was being a dick to everyone backstage. But he was never really given the opportunity, I think, that he deserved. You know, when MVP came into the company back in 2006, when I first heard about this guy, I had no idea who he was, and I heard he was coming in. His name was MVP. I remember when he first debuted, Teddy Long, who was the SmackDown general manager, there was a whole big hullabaloo about this new guy coming in, and I think they made a bid for him, and they got him, and they had like a press conference or something on WWE.com. And all I kept thinking was, who the fuck is this guy? And why is it such a big deal that he's on SmackDown? So he really wasn't a big deal at first. They just wanted to build him up. And slowly but surely, he built himself up as a pretty credible heel character. You know, he became the United States champion a couple of times. He had memorable feuds with Chris Benoit, Matt Hardy, who he's actually really good friends with now in real life. Eventually, he was moved over to the Raw brand, which I thought was exactly the move he needed. I thought he was floundering on SmackDown. Raw was the A show. Put this guy on Raw. So they finally moved him over to the Raw brand. I believe it was probably last year, maybe 08. And I remember his first night in, if I remember correctly, he was cutting a promo on, I want to say, Randy Orton. But whoever it was, he cut a really, really good promo on that first night, got a great reaction from the crowd, and was promptly buried. They didn't do anything with him. They beat him down. They made him look like a jobber. He didn't get much promo time after that first night. And it got to the point where it was like, all right, you got to get him off Raw. I mean, this guy is absolutely being wasted. Wasted potential to the max. Get him back on SmackDown as quickly as possible. And he was actually drafted back to Friday nights as part of the supplemental draft earlier this year. And even then, they did not do much with him. Which is surprising to me because Michael Hayes, who was the head writer for SmackDown, is one of the biggest MVP fans in the company. But apparently his enthusiasm for the MVP character didn't really amount to much because Vince McMahon and the people in power just didn't want to do anything with the guy. So if the guy's not being used to his full potential and he wants to leave the company, then why not grant him his release? And that's what WWE did. The interesting part about this, from what I understand, is that MVP may actually own the rights to the MVP character. This may not be a situation where WWE owns the MVP name and character and he has to change his name. You know, for example, if he goes to TNA or if he works the independents, he may be able to continue calling himself MVP and dressing the exact same way if he wants to. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what I've heard, which is interesting. I don't know how that arrangement came about, but apparently the character may have been his idea, maybe his to own. So if it is, good for him. If he works the indies, if he can work under the MVP name with the same costume that he wears, for lack of a better term, the same gear, he could probably get more money that way instead of calling himself Montel Smith or whatever. Unfortunately, as a lot of guys have to do. I mean, look at Luke Gallows. You know, Luke Gallows is an example of a guy who got cut recently. He got cut. He didn't ask for his release. He can't use the Luke Gallows name. He can't use the Festus name. You know, he's got to call himself, you know, Big LG or something because he doesn't have the rights. So, in any event, the question is, what now for MVP? MVP has openly talked about wanting to have at least one match in his career with Masahiro Chono in Japan, who's a big Japanese star. In fact, Chono was in WCW. Chono was part of the NWO at one point. Chono was a lot older. Chono has had pretty bad neck issues. And I don't know if he's wrestling much these days, but I think if MVP could get over to Japan and have a match with Chono, he'd probably be very happy to do that. Perhaps MVP wants to do some tours with All Japan. You know, if you watch him in the ring, he clearly has adapted his style after Japanese wrestling. You know, the Yakuza kick and everything else. That's all Japanese stuff. You know, and he's talked about watching and studying Japanese tapes. He'd be backstage at the events studying tapes of Chono and that sort of thing and integrating it into his moveset. So I could easily see him wanting to go overseas, do some wrestling in Japan. I don't know how interested TNA would be in him. I think if this were 2 or 3 years ago, they would snatch him up right away, or after 90 days, they would snatch him up. But again, TNA has tightened the purse strings a lot. I mean, unless your name is John Cena or Randy Orton, I don't think TNA is necessarily going to be able to just sign whoever they want to. Now, Matt Hardy, of course, is an exception to that. I'm almost positive that within the next month or two, you know, given his brother being in the company and all that, that Matt Hardy will be in TNA. But I don't know that an MVP is going to be in TNA, at least not anytime soon. I mean, let's be honest here. Is MVP really going to come to TNA and make that much of an impact? Is he going to make that much of a difference? I mean, here's a company with TNA that has brought in the likes of Kurt Angle, Sting, Mick Foley, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, the two biggest stars in the history of this business, and they still continue to draw the same 1.1 rating every week. It's almost demoralizing if you think about it. It doesn't matter who they bring in. It never seems to make a difference. I wonder why that is, because talent has never been a problem for TNA. And MVP is a talented guy. I would love to see him go to TNA and become a big star. Talent has never, ever been TNA's problem. It's creative, but I'm kind of tired of talking about that, so I don't harp on that too much anymore, because what's the point? They don't want to make a change, and so things are just going to continue to stay the same way that they are. But, you know, when I posted the MVP getting released item on SE Scoops yesterday, I you know, there's tons of comments in the comments section, almost 40 comments at last count. A lot of people very upset, blaming WWE. Let it be known, this was not WWE's fault. I mean, you can blame WWE for not pushing the guy, but this was MVP's request, and WWE simply granted it to him. Speaking of TNA, they have a pay-per-view this weekend, Final Resolution. And the updated lineup looks a little bit like this. Jeff Hardy will defend his TNA title in a rematch from last month with Matt Morgan. Mr. Anderson will be the special guest referee. Of course, Anderson is still being kept out of action as a precautionary measure after the concussion that he suffered, I guess, last month at the hands of Jeff Hardy in an errant chair shot. I caught the last 20 minutes or so of reaction. I didn't even see Impact. I saw the last 20 minutes of reaction last night. And Matt Morgan is a hell of a talker. You know, in that environment, again, the one thing I love about reaction is that it feels real. These guys are not doing scripted promos like you would see in WWE or even on Impact. That's what makes reaction so enjoyable and refreshing. And Matt Morgan in that environment, being able to cut a promo with the blood on his face from the attack, I guess, that he suffered earlier in the night on Impact, he was cutting a hell of a promo. He was jaw-jacking, and he really came off as this monster guy who was going to go to the pay-per-view and kick some ass, and that's great. It just sucks that Matt Morgan is shitty in the ring, and a Jeff Hardy-Matt Morgan match is not going to draw any buys on pay-per-view, but I was impressed by Morgan's promo that he was cutting towards the end of reaction. We have Jeff Jarrett against Samoa Joe in a submission match. We have a casket match, whatever. Abyss against the Pope. We have a first blood match between RVD and Rhino. TNA Tag Team title match. The Motor City Machine Guns defend against Generation Me in Full Metal Mayhem. Tara will battle Mickie James in a False Count Anywhere match, so apparently Mickie James is not getting a title shot on pay-per-view. TV champion AJ Styles against Douglas Williams and Robbie E., the reigning TNA X Division champion, against Jay Lethal with Cookie in a Cage above the ring. Bear Money will also battle Ink Inc. So there's your lineup for Final Resolution for the 20 people listening to this who will buy the TNA pay-per-view this weekend. All right, let's bust open the mailbag here. It's been a couple of weeks since we've done this. And by the way, you can check out the latest SE Scoops mailbag on the main page. I posted that up yesterday. So if you haven't already had a chance, check that out. We got some good questions, some bad questions, as always. But check that out if you have not already done so. Luis writes in, Dear Solid Monster, does Steve Austin actually work for WWE anymore? Does he have a Legends contract? Also, did WWE Films default on Austin's multi-picture deal? He said he would be the cornerstone of that division when the announcement was made in March of 2005, but so far he has only been part of the most high-profile and expensive film, or flop, that they've made. That film was a flop. The Condemned, which, of course, they blame Lionsgate for not doing enough marketing of the film, but that, I think, to this day, is the only WWE film, I believe, that they've actually lost money on. And so I don't know that they've defaulted on the deal. Perhaps the deal is still intact, but they simply have not engaged Austin in any further talks to do any additional pictures. Austin, of course, continues to make movies independently. I saw what his latest film, Hunt to Kill, in fact, I saw a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was good for what it was. Is Austin still with WWE, though? Yes. And I don't believe it's a Legends deal. In fact, I know it's not a Legends contract, the likes of which they have with a lot of the other legends. They actually have Austin signed to a separate contract that is unique to him. And it is a very lucrative contract. And the only reason they have him signed to that contract is specifically to keep him away from TNA and any other wrestling organization that may sprout up with television. They do not want Steve Austin to defect anywhere. And so the purpose of having him signed to that very lucrative contract, and I don't know what the length of it is. I don't know if it's a lifetime deal, if it goes year to year. I have no idea. But they have him signed to a special contract specifically to keep him away from companies like TNA. That's all I know. It's kind of like Shawn Michaels. You know, when Shawn Michaels was hurt for those 4 years and out of action with a back injury, he was still getting paid. They had him signed to a contract so he couldn't go anywhere else. And he was getting paid, I think it was something along the lines of like $15,000 a week or something to that effect. I would imagine they have a similar deal, maybe even a little more lucrative with Austin. Josh writes in, Dear Solid Monster, I had a question for you. Who do you think The Miz could have as a great feud with down the line? With Miz, of course, being the heel champion. I was thinking about it, and I think a heel Miz against a face Sheamus could be a great program within the next couple of years. Your thoughts? It could be, but I think The Miz and Daniel Bryan resuming their feud for the WWE title would be fantastic. Now, if you recall, Bryan has multiple clean submission wins over The Miz just a couple of months ago. You know, it's kind of one of those deals where you'll do a couple of jobs and they'll push you down right before they give you the big push. That's what they did with The Miz. And they gave Daniel Bryan a couple of clean wins over him on pay-per-view, and you know, Daniel Bryan's on a hell of a win streak of late, so it's not going to happen in the immediate future, but I think Miz and Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship, fantastic stuff. I would welcome the opportunity to see that. Got a letter here from Sarmin, who's a relatively new listener to the podcast, been listening since episode 120. Let's see here. He had a chance to watch the Thanksgiving episode of Impact and thought it was pretty good as far as their promos and ability to create an interesting or realistic storyline for one episode and not talk about the pay-per-view that much was great. I'm also a big fan of their backstage promos. I know you've mentioned this before, and I'm a big fan of that. My question is, what did you think of that episode of Impact if you had a chance to watch it? Well, I didn't, so I can't comment on it. And in large part, I didn't because I was just... I wasn't really even in the mood to watch anything on TV. I was suffering, unfortunately, over this Thanksgiving holiday. So, but even if I wasn't suffering, I'm not sure if I would have been able to watch Impact. It was, after all, Thanksgiving. By the way, you know, TNA has a very loyal core audience. In the past, they've actually been able to maintain their ratings over Thanksgiving for the most part. I think Impact on Thanksgiving did a 0.9, which is only down slightly from their usual rating. I think Reaction did a 0.5, but all things considered, on a holiday like Thanksgiving, to pull a number like that is pretty impressive. So, yeah, I didn't see the actual show, although I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that was the night, and it didn't happen on Impact. I think it happened on Reaction, where Dixie Carter made her return appearance. Apparently they're working Dixie Carter back into the storylines, and she's fighting back, and I guess on Impact this week they did a thing at the beginning where it was almost like they wrote Hulk Hogan out of the show. You know, I don't know where they're going with that, but I think Dixie made her first appearance. It was Thanksgiving night on Reaction, if I'm not mistaken. Why you would have Dixie make her comeback appearance again? This is your big storyline, your number one storyline, and to save that for A, Thanksgiving, when less people are going to be watching, and B, to do it on Reaction instead of your main show, Impact. Again, if I'm not mistaken, I am not sure why you would do that. But apparently that's what TNA did. So, but I didn't see the show, so I can't comment on it. Got an anonymous email here. Perhaps it's the Raw GM writing in. He says, "Dear Solemn Monster, I am not a John Cena fan, but do you think it is a plot by WWE to sell more copies of his new DVD? And perhaps that is why he left. Or is he leaving for a while because he's going to make another movie? Been listening since episode one. I listened to you on my Android phone. Love the show. Thanks a lot." Well, thanks for the email. I like your idea that it's a plot. This whole storyline was a plot to sell more DVDs. No, they're not that smart. They don't think that far ahead. As for making a movie, he is, I think, either filming or going to be filming another movie. But, you know, this email came in before John Cena showed up on Raw Monday night, and obviously he's not going anywhere. So, if he's making movies, he's making movies on days other than Monday, because he's still showing up on Raw every week. Nothing really has changed. Tony writes in, says, "Kurt Angle said on his Twitter recently that WWE is really missing big names like himself, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, The Rock, Steve Austin, etc. What are your thoughts on that? Personally, I think that without those guys, WWE is fine. Don't get me wrong, if they had those guys back, they'd probably do better business, but I'd rather they continue to build new stars like The Miz, Sheamus, and others." He also said that TNA has incredible talent, which is true, but if you look at TNA and see who they're showcasing on television, it doesn't really matter if Bischoff, Hogan, Jarrett, etc. are going to take up all of the television time. What are your thoughts? Well, on that first front, it's absolutely true. WWE is severely missing people like Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho and even Triple H on TV, because you can juggle the past and the present. In fact, the whole point is to use the past to get over the present. Now, I don't know that Triple H is going to come back and start doing jobs for Sheamus and The Miz, but if you take a guy like a Shawn Michaels, I can almost guarantee you that if Shawn Michaels were still on TV, you know, Shawn Michaels would be putting over and working with some of these younger guys. I think that's the best formula. You want to have star power. Every television show needs star power. John Cena will only go so far. Randy Orton is only going to go so far. What other big stars do they really have? Mysterio? Maybe. Undertaker's not even on TV full-time anymore. They're really hurting right now in the main event department. And I like what they're doing with The Miz. I want them to continue to push people like him and Sheamus. And they can do that, but you can still have big-name stars on television. So I agree with Kurt in that respect. And by the way, if Kurt wants to come back to WWE, I would certainly welcome him back with open arms. Because if Kurt has proven one thing, it's that he can still go out there and put on the best match on the show. Now, for his own personal health and well-being, I don't know that working a WWE schedule would be in his best interest. So TNA is probably still the best place for him, but I would certainly love to see Kurt Angle back one day in WWE. Now, as far as the point that Tony makes about TNA, obviously I agree with Kurt. I just said this a couple of minutes ago. They have incredible talent on their roster. Top to bottom, their roster probably is more talented than WWE. but it's all about how you showcase that talent. And you're absolutely right. Dixie Carter, Eric Bischoff, Hulk Hogan, Jeff Jarrett, in addition, of course, to Jeff Hardy and Mr. Anderson and people like that, are taking up a majority of the TV time. I can appreciate them putting Matt Morgan in the main event slot and giving him a chance, even though he's not that good. He's good on the mic. He's not that good in the ring. But let's be honest here. The only reason Matt Morgan is in the main event right now is because Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Anderson, got smacked in the back of the head with a chair by Jeff Hardy a little too hard. If it wasn't for the concussion, it would be Anderson in the main event right now. They probably never would have even turned Matt Morgan babyface in the first place. So I can give them credit, but only up until a point. The focus of their TV shows is still all the old guys. Compared to WWE, where, say what you want to about the product right now, they're featuring The Miz as their champion. They're pushing Sheamus, who is a young guy. I mean, I know it doesn't feel that way, and people like to look at Sheamus as Triple H's workout buddy, but Sheamus is where he is right now because he's really, really good, and he deserves it. And, you know, they're trying to push guys like Morrison and Alberto Del Rio and Dolph Ziggler and Daniel Bryan. I give them a hell of a lot, and Wade Barrett. I give them a hell of a lot of credit for that. They're doing a better job pushing younger talent now than TNA is. If anything, it should be the other way around. It's always been WWE pushing the older guys, and TNA used to be the company that you could buy a pay-per-view and see them showcase all their young stars in great four-star matches. And now I won't say that it's reversed, but it's certainly not like it used to be. Reese from Berkeley Springs writes in with a question. Dear Solid Monster, been a fan since Sound Off 88. My question is, although I agree with your opinion on the greatest of all time when it comes to selling tickets, those being the likes of Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin, is it fair to say that the greatest of all time, all-around performer in the history of wrestling is easily Shawn Michaels? Has another performer ever had the entire package, so to speak, and not just excel at one quality? What are your thoughts? To say that Shawn Michaels is easily the greatest of all time is completely incorrect. No, it is not easy to say that Shawn Michaels is the greatest all-around performer in the history of wrestling. Again, if we're talking wrestling here, and you didn't say WWE, so I assume that you're talking wrestling overall, the answer is no. You know, Michaels, now if you're talking the total package, which of course would include promo ability and playing to the crowd in addition to work rate in the ring, I still don't think Shawn Michaels is the greatest of all time. Now, I am not a Japan aficionado. Okay, I'm not a big expert on Japanese wrestling, but I know enough to know the big names, and I know enough to know that people like Mitsuharu Misawa, Kenta Kobashi, okay, people, those two names in particular jump into my head, are probably better all-around performers than Shawn Michaels. You know, Misawa died, unfortunately, it was either earlier this year or last year, actually died in the ring. Kobashi still wrestles, although his body has been just completely, especially with that Japanese style, wrestling as long as he has. You know, he went through a bout with cancer, I think kidney cancer several years ago that he beat, but Kobashi's body has just been ravaged. But if you go on YouTube, and actually there were some wicked battles between Misawa and Kobashi. If you go on YouTube, you could probably find those matches. You'll cringe at some of the suplexes that they give each other. Those two names in particular from Japan stand out as the greatest of all time. I mean, Shawn Michaels probably couldn't even come close in the ring with those guys. But again, it's a little unfair because you're talking two totally different styles. You know, Michaels did not work the Japanese stiff style of wrestling. He worked a completely different style. On the microphone, Michaels was great. I don't know, speaking in terms of Japanese wrestling, what the promo ability was like of Misawa and Kobashi, because I don't talk Japanese. So it's possible they were shitty on the microphone and just great in the ring, in which case you might, you know, your argument might be bolstered. As far as an all-around performer, Michaels, look, Michaels was great, and Michaels has to be considered amongst the greatest of all time. But to say that, is it easy to assume that Shawn Michaels is the best in the history of wrestling? when it comes to all of these qualities and you know, match quality and all that stuff, no, it's not easy at all. In fact, it's one of the hardest questions to ask. Who is the greatest of all time? It's one of the hardest questions you could possibly ask somebody. You know, we went through the whole thing with the whole top 50 greatest of all time thing on the last podcast. It's not an easy question. You know, WWE completely butchered that list, you know, but they could have done a much better job of putting together a list that people can have a legitimate debate about, you know, but when you have a list that has, you know, Hulk Hogan at number 23 and Bruno at number 24 and fucking JYD on the list, that's a pretty shitty list. So it's a great question, but no, it's not so easy to call Shawn Michaels the best of all time if you're speaking about professional wrestling. Now, if you're talking WWE, you can make that argument. If you're talking the big three companies, WWE, WCW, ECW, you can make that argument. But when you open it up to Japan and you open it up to Mexico and you open it up to all these other places in the world where they wrestled totally different styles, but Michaels would hardly be considered the greatest of all time. Our buddy Sky writes into the podcast, was awesome. Thanks for posting episode 26 of The Sound Off on Facebook. Listening to it got me through my physics class, which was incredibly boring because I failed to read the night before and had no idea what the hell he was talking about. I've been there before. But thanks for that. For those of you who don't know, again, in my illness and not knowing when I would be able to do a new show, there were two classic vintage sound offs that I linked to through Facebook and Twitter. I didn't post it on SE Scoops. So go on Twitter, go on Facebook. You can find the links there to episode 50 of The Sound Off, and which was actually a post-Thanksgiving show from 2008. And episode 26, which was from Memorial Day 2008, and was the very first special edition of The Sound Off I ever did. I did a top five matches/feuds fantasy deal that I'd like to see in WWE, but it wasn't fantasy so much in that it could, they were realistic enough that these matches could actually happen and still could. But that was also the show that I tore into the Hogan family and played that audio, the jailhouse audio, which it's a classic episode. So if you want to check it out, you can find the link on my Facebook, friend me on there, and yeah, check it out. So thanks for the kind words. Couple more questions here before we wrap it up. With Hulk Hogan missing out on both WrestleMania 10 and 20, do you think he will be back in the fold by WrestleMania 30? Well, I don't have a crystal ball here, but anything's possible, I'm sure. We have not seen the last of Hulk Hogan in WWE. Let's put it that way. At some point, Hogan is going to be back. He's going to be honored. He's not going to be in TNA forever. He will be back. I don't know if it'll be in time for WrestleMania 30. In fact, the fact that he missed 10 and 20 probably leads me to believe he'll miss 30 as well, unfortunately. And that's a shame, because he deserves to be there. He is synonymous with WrestleMania, the very first WrestleMania, Madison Square Garden. That's where Hulkamania was born. I remember vividly being very upset when WrestleMania 10 rolled around. And you may remember at WrestleMania 10, they had the gimmick where there was a double main event. It was going to be Yokozuna defending the title against Lex Luger in the first title match, and then the winner of that would defend the title against Bret Hart in the main event, who, of course, lost to his brother Owen in the opening contest. But the two championship matches were going to have mystery guest referees. And I was convinced, I was positive, that Hulk Hogan was going to be one of these referees. So Mr. Perfect, of course, Kurt Hennig, was the referee for the first title match, which played into the finish. And when they were getting ready to announce the referee for the main event, I was convinced that it was going to be Hulk Hogan. Because remember, Hogan wasn't doing anything wrestling-wise at that point. In March of 94, you know, he was probably working on his Thunder in Paradise show, but he had not yet signed with WCW. So I was convinced, and then when they announced Rowdy Roddy Piper, God bless Hot Rod, I was pissed. That was a huge letdown for me at that time. And then WrestleMania 20, you know, was disappointing also. I mean, Hogan came back to WWE. He was part of WrestleMania 18 against The Rock. He had a great match with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania 19. And Hogan had a cameo appearance and beat up Hassan and Daivari and saved Eugene at WrestleMania 21. And yet sandwiched in the middle there was WrestleMania 20 at the Garden, and Hogan wasn't there for it. So, very disappointing. Second question here. If Goldberg does participate in WrestleMania 27, Do you think it would be part of a quick squash, possibly involving Santino, a la the high-quality filler segment that Hogan had, that I just mentioned, at WrestleMania 21? That's a ridiculous question. First of all, if Goldberg is going to be at WrestleMania, he's going to wrestle a match. And if they sign Goldberg to a contract to wrestle at WrestleMania, it's going to be a lucrative deal for Bill Goldberg. And there's absolutely no way that WWE is going to pay Goldberg $1 million or more to show up at WrestleMania to have a squash with Santino Marella. That is just completely ridiculous to even think that they would offer him enough money to come to Mania to do something like that. So, no, it's not going to happen. Last question here from our buddy Airborne. Dear Solomonster, huge fan of your podcast, have been since Sound Off 107, where you told us about your joyride vacation through Costa Rica. When I heard about Jerry the King Lawler getting his first title opportunity at this point in his career, it reminded me of a wrestler WWE released earlier in the year, who should have been world champion. I'm talking about Shelton Benjamin. He's a great athlete and all, and I've heard rumors from friends of mine that he was given an opportunity at the title, but refused because he was afraid of the pressure. My question is this true? Was he really afraid of the spotlight? I find that hard to believe, because I remember when he was drafted to Raw back in 04, he had a crazy feud with Triple H and even pinned him 1-2-3. He had Triple H's number, and at one point I do recall Evolution being involved. It would have been good to see him become world champion then because he was getting a really big push. So what happened? I don't know who your friends are getting their information from, but no. Shelton Benjamin was never offered the chance to be champion and turned it down because he was too afraid. That's that's even more ridiculous than the Goldberg question. But no. Shelton Benjamin was just never given an opportunity, period. You know, he had every chance to become a bigger star. And what doomed Shelton Benjamin was a combination of things. You can blame WWE, but you can also blame Shelton Benjamin. There was a perception by some backstage in WWE that Shelton Benjamin didn't have the drive that somebody like The Miz, for example, has exhibited. In that, there, you know, The Miz is somebody who has gone out of his way to prove to the company and outright tell the company, listen, I'm willing to take on the responsibilities of being your go-to media guy. I'll do all the public relations that you want me to. I'll let it consume my life. I will do everything in my power to get better, which The Miz has gotten better in the ring. He has improved on his off days. He does improv classes in L.A., which is why his promos have gotten so much better, and he's gotten a lot wittier over the years, although he's always been a witty guy, going back to his reality show days. But and by the way, speaking of that, for those of you who haven't listened to it, Bill Simmons does a great podcast for ESPN.com called The BS Report. He just had The Miz on yesterday for over an hour. Great interview. So I would go over to ESPN.com right now and find that show and listen to it. Miz was great on that podcast. They talk about the real world and his days of doing the reality stuff on MTV, first coming into WWE. They talk about wrestling from the 80s. Winning the title and facing Jerry Lawler on Monday night, all that stuff. So check it out. But anyway, so there was a perception that Shelton Benjamin was unable or unwilling to do that sort of thing. And the one thing they wanted Shelton to get better on were his promos. Because as great as he was in the ring, and he's a phenomenal athlete, his promos leave a lot to be desired. And for better or worse, in WWE, and really in wrestling in general on TV these days, if you can't talk on the microphone, your opportunities are going to be severely limited. Because again, this is not an era where wrestling managers are prevalent. You know, Shelton Benjamin is a classic example of somebody who probably would benefit by having a manager. You know, back in the day, if Shelton Benjamin were brought into the company as this great in-ring competitor, he'd probably be managed by somebody like a Bobby Heenan or a Jim Cornette. And unfortunately, Bobby Heenan and Jim Cornette, they don't grow on trees. And the ones who are talented enough to be managers, and they have people in developmental who can be a great manager. There's people out there right now on the independent circuit who can be a great manager. But Vince McMahon does not believe in managers. It's too Southern wrestling for him, and he doesn't want to do it. So people like Shelton Benjamin suffer, but Benjamin, if he would have improved his game in that department, he would have really opened up a lot of eyes, I think, and done better for himself. And then you can also blame WWE because they don't realize, in some cases, the talent that they have at their disposal. You know, Shelton Benjamin may have been the best pure athlete on their roster until they fired him. You know, but is that enough? Would Shelton Benjamin have made a great world heavyweight champion? You know what? I don't know that he would have. I think The Miz probably makes a much better world champion than Shelton Benjamin, which is not to say that The Miz is better in the ring. It's not to say that The Miz is a better athlete. He's not. The Miz would tell you that himself. But as far as being the package that they're looking for, being a good enough wrestler in the ring while at the same time having the personality and having that gift of gab on the microphone, The Miz is more of the total package than Shelton Benjamin ever was. So, you know, I mean, look, I was a big Shelton Benjamin supporter. I thought it was stupid when they let him go, and I think he could have done a lot better for himself than he did. He was a tag team champion. He was an intercontinental champion. What more do you want? You know, WWE can only do so much. Shelton Benjamin could have done a lot more on his own to improve his verbal skills. There wasn't really much improvement, I think, in the ring that he needed, but he could have improved in other areas. I mean, look, in WWE, you got to play the game. John Cena knew how to play the game. The Miz knows how to play the game. Shelton Benjamin always came off to me as being somebody who just didn't care enough. He was like, I don't want to be bought. I don't want to play games. I just want to go in there and wrestle. And that's fine. But in WWE, you got to do more than just wrestle. You know, in Ring of Honor, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas have reunited as a tag team. They had a match with the Kings of Wrestling not too long ago in ROH at the Manhattan Center. And they had what was probably the greatest tag team match, and people have said this, the greatest tag team match that they've ever seen. Nobody doubts that Shelton Benjamin is a great wrestler. But to be world heavyweight champion these days, you know, it's not the 70s. You can't get away with just being a good wrestler, you know? Shelton Benjamin would kind of be the black version of Bob Backlund if this were 1978. And Shelton may have gone on to have a great five-year run with the belt. But it's not 1978, it's 2010. And some guys have it, some guys don't. I would not have gotten rid of Shelton Benjamin, but I can't tell you that if I were booking WWE, he'd be my world champion right now. In fact, I'm almost positive that he would not be my world champion right now. If anything, he'd probably still be doing tag matches with Charlie Haas as the best team in the entire company because he seems to be more well-suited for a role like that. You know, he does come off as being a little shy. I'm not sure that he would be the best person to be going around doing interviews like The Miz is doing right now. But again, this notion that he was offered the chance or that WWE had him pegged for a world title run and he simply couldn't handle the pressure and he turned it down is preposterous. It's complete fantasy. It never happened. He was never given that chance. So on that note, we're going to cinch up the mailbag here. A lot of good questions this week. Keep them coming. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. We're back in business here on the Sound Off, so I want more questions from you guys. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. Our Twitter count keeps going up. Twitter.com/Solomonster. And, of course, friend me on Facebook. You never know when I may post a vintage Sound Off on there. So go to Facebook.com/TheSolomonster, and you can send me a friend request. I'm usually pretty quick with that stuff. I'll get you on there right away. And you can subscribe to this very podcast through iTunes. It's free. It doesn't cost you a dime. And as soon as a new show goes up, it's automatically downloaded for you. You don't have to do anything. So for all you lazy listeners out there, it's the best possible solution for all of you. Sign up on iTunes if you have not already done so. Thanks again to everybody for the well wishes and everything. I am on the mend again. I am not quite there yet. My voice is coming around. I sound better than I did 4 days ago. Believe you me. And no more steroids and pain pills for me. I've weaned myself off that. So WWE wants to give me a wellness test I should pass with flying colors. I can't say the same for a couple of days ago, but I'm clean now, so that's all that maters. Be back next weekend, episode 137 of The Sound Off, right here on SEScoops.com. Again, thanks to everybody as always, for all of your support. Keep on listening. Spread the good word of the Sound Off. And we'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.